This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytech, brings you Blowing Bubbles. Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world. How are people living their bubble lives? Working from home, keeping kids entertained, and staying connected and getting exercise. And how are these things presenting us with the opportunities to find new ways of living? Every weekday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann, Shan Gallagher, and Mara Karatai reach out from their bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world. Broadcast on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz and sustainablelens.org, bringing connection, joy, kindness and peace in the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann. I'm not in Sawyers Bay, Dunedin today. I am in Hyderabad. I am on the campus of IIIT, International Institute Information Technology in Hyderabad, and I'm in the office of Associate Professor Venkatesh Chappella with Dr. Radhika Krishnan. Venkatesh says he has interests in software architecture and computer science, and he has Danella Meadows' systems thinking book on his desk. That's the important thing. And Radhika is a political ecologist. Welcome. Welcome to your office.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Samuel, for this morning. We're looking forward to talking to you.
Venkatesh, where did you grow up?
I was born in South India. It was a steel town called Visakhapatnam. It's a coastal town, but I never lived there. I grew up mostly in North India, and this little another big industrial town called Kanpur. And I had all my education there till my undergraduate. And then I moved out, went to the South, studied there. Then I was in the U.S. for many years. Then we came back about 20 years ago from the U.S. Been here in Hyderabad and also in other parts of South India since then.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be a physicist. It was quite glamorous. Everybody around was saying physics is good. So, yeah.
But I'm not seeing many physics things around here. Well, I'm seeing things, but I suppose it is physics things.
Yeah, I ended up doing physics. I ended up studying computer science. So I got involved with computers and so on. But yeah, that's what I was when I was trying to grow up. I wanted to be, later on I wanted to be either a musician or a scientist or a journalist. And it looks like I was none of these three.
I hear there's a bit of musician though.
Yeah, a bit of each, a bit of the music part and the science part. I guess I didn't quite make it to journalism, although I'd love to do it.
And Radhika, where'd you grow up?
I was born in South India, in fact in a very lovely small hill town of Kunur in Tamil Nadu in South India. I grew up in a steel township in central India, Chhattisgarh, in the township of Bhilai in Chhattisgarh, right in the center of this huge country that's India. I have a little bit of India, all over India in me, could say that.
One of the things that surprised me about India is the different cultures. It's certainly not one culture. Mm-hmm. No. Moving around, did you experience different cultures?
Absolutely. I experienced a lot of cultures because India is, as you say, it's a potpourri of all sorts of rituals and food styles and living styles and dress styles and everything. And there are some very funny stories around cultural clashes right in India. And I've experienced that because I've grown up across the country. But till very recently, it was basically, there was some well-intentioned ripping of different people's cultures. But it's never really been nasty beyond a point till pretty recently. There used to be, for example, a lot of fun being made of accents and so on. I'm sure that exists across the globe, but in India, South Indian accents, in the north, there was a lot of fun made of South Indian accents and of in the south, fun made of accents in some parts of eastern India and so on. But that's, And food styles are very, very different. Eating habits, recipes. The same vegetable, boring vegetable, can be made in some, at least 24 types across the country if you do a survey.
So a place like Hyderabad, does it act as a melting pot? Does it bring people together from those different cultures?
I think the Hyderabad
issue... Hyderabad's an interesting place because it's what's called the Deccan Plateau of India. So so it's really really sort of separating South India with the North. And over the centuries, many parts of India, people have come from various parts of India, including the outside the Indian subcontinent, and have just come and settled here. So Hyderabad's a very interesting place in that respect because it has a lot of the local... for example, if you look at the history of Hyderabad, you had the, you had the Qutub Shahi kings, and you had, I think like what, 16th century or even before, and you've had a beautiful mix of, what typically would go by South Indian and Deccan Muslim North Indian culture. So I think one of the things about India is it's probably more reasonable to think of India as a subcontinent or a continent. Like Europe, with lots of little nations, if you will, states. In fact, they are called nations, they're called Rashtra. So they are. So India is really to have an identity as a country. I think the thing that unites this geographical region, if you will, is not so much a religion or anything else, but just the fact that civilization is just a mosaic of lots of different peoples, and I think that's the point many of us miss because we try to look at a country only along one dimension, whether it's religion or language or something else, and it just doesn't fit that description.
And Radhika, what did you want to be when you grew up? You thought I'd forgotten.
Well, I guess I wanted to be an engineer, and I did become an engineer, but fate had other plans for me, and I, the minute I became an engineer, graduated as an engineer, I realized I didn't want to be there. So I guess that's the story of many of us. I hated my job as a coder. That was my first job, and I hated it. And I got interested in environment and environmental studies and so on. So slowly moved there. It did take me some energy to move from engineering to the social sciences, and I did expend that energy because I was so interested in doing it. But I wanted to be an engineer. I guess that came with the territory. I grew up in a steel township where everybody was doing, either wanting to be an engineer, most people wanted to be engineers, or doctors. That's about it. So,
You're still working in a institution of engineers, so you didn't leave engineering to do this environmental stuff. You've managed to find a way of doing it inside engineering.
Yes, and frankly, I always wanted to teach in an engineering institute, partly because I felt this is very personal. When I was being trained as an engineer, I felt that the training that engineers get is remarkably narrow. And engineers in India, at least, are not trained to think about the world. They're not really trained to think about society, about nature, and so on. And I wanted to be that person who would contribute to the process of widening people's minds, engineering, engineering students and the way they think about the world. So that's why I chose to teach in an engineering institute, and I'm very happy I'm here. Talking about what I do will be, I'm involved in a program which tries to do confluence, which is bringing together computational tools and social science frameworks. And I do use GIS to do environmental studies. I use a fair bit of NLP tools with my students to study environmental discourses and so on. So, but it's a work in progress. There's a lot that needs to be done, and there's a lot that I'm experimenting with.
How do you convince these wannabe engineers that they should take what you're doing seriously and not just a, what are you doing? How do you catch them? How do you catch their interest?
That's an excellent question, I think. I think the trick is to sort of connect the classroom, connect the academic curriculum and the academic material that you're trying to use in the classroom to real life experiences. And I start off my class, my first class in environmental studies, with a simple poll. I ask my students, what have you seen in the world? Have you seen a manufacturing industry? Have you been to a national park? Have you been to the sea? Have you been to a village? Mm-hmm. What have you done? And inevitably, the answer is no. Most engineering students in India, they're rural, they've grown up in cities, and they haven't really gone beyond that bubble that is the Indian city. And once they reach 9th grade or 10th grade, they enter into this complete treadmill of preparing for engineering exams and so on, and their life comes to a standstill, their social life comes to a standstill. So I start my first class by telling them what they are missing out on and what they can expect to learn if they open up their minds and if they start traveling either literally or figuratively into different worlds. And that, I think, helps. And I like to think that enthusiasm is infectious. So if you're enthusiastic as a teacher, at least one part of the classroom will catch on to that infection and will say, all right, why is this person so thrilled about the idea of going to a national park and finding out what is happening, what are the politics around that you get to see in a national park, and so on. And that, to some extent, works. I love throwing these extremely provocative and correct statements sometimes by saying, look, don't think about nature being harmonious, because nature is not about harmony. Nature is a very wild space which is about a lot of conflict. And that upsets their set notions. And I think that's a good starting point to get them interested. Okay, why is this teacher saying what they're saying?
There used to be a saying that was associated with the idea of how many planets are we using up, and if we were all using up as much resources as somebody in Northern Europe or the States, we'd need whatever it is, 7 or 8 or 9, it doesn't really matter, it's more than one. And that if we were to develop to that level, and we can't, clearly, but we can't stop the Global South from doing that development because we can't begrudge somebody a fridge. And I suspect in India you've got that internally. There must be levels of development. How does that work, or how's that thought of in India? Is it that everybody is aspiring for the top, and if everybody aspires for the top, then the world's not going to be able to sustain it? How's that managed?
Okay, there are two ways of looking at this. One, I'm sure most people are familiar with this, but when the first Kyoto discussions happened, India was actually one of the very interesting thought leaders, if you may, because we had come up, the Indian contingent in the first climate discussions, had come up with this very interesting notion of subsistence emissions, saying, look, you cannot punish people for simply wanting to exist. And so don't compare emissions from a poor farmer in Bangladesh or Ethiopia with someone in New Zealand or England or wherever, So I think we've really moved very, very far from that narrative in India, unfortunately. And that's exactly what you're talking about. Indian per capita emissions of a particular class in India, mm-hmm, is equal, if not more, than the average per capita emissions in in the so-called developed West. So we do have classes here. And what's, I think, interesting here is, globally there's this understanding that one should not think of the Global South as a hegemonic space. And one will have to figure out ways of separating classes of Indians from each other, So, and policies will have to be designed to figure this out, because there is this whole aspiration of wanting to be like an average American or an average Britisher and so on. And many Indians are living that life today. This morning before we started this podcast, I was telling you my irritation with cities. One reason for that irritation is that every city is so similar in some ways. You have the same KFC, you have the same Swedish IKEA, you have the, the lifestyle is so similar because people are living such similar levels of emissions. So that's one level. The second level, at a policy level again, what we are arguing is that, look, when you talk to a global audience, you do talk about how India is, the global south needs to be separated from, say, the industrialized world. But internally, one has to understand the responsibilities that we have to reduce emissions. So it's a kind of dual thing, that dual strategy that one needs to employ.
Let's take the first of your music choices.
Okay, it's called Gaon Chhodan Nahi. I don't want to leave the village.
Yes, we don't want to leave our village.
It's really a statement. Actually, it's an indictment of all development.
Yes.
From a villager who is generally being kind of impacted and affected by it. I don't have the lyrics of the song in front of me.
But I can know quite a bit of it.
Yeah,
see,
you know more about
basically
it.
Basically, what I tend to talk about how Venkatesh and I, reached that song. So we were doing this very interesting class with our first years, where we were supposed to do what is called value education, and we were asked to talk about the environment. So we started off by playing this song and getting our students to discuss it, and that just became our favorite song for a while. So it essentially says, as Venkatesh correctly points out, it's an indictment of the kind of development that you see in the global south. So the song goes, it's a us versus them song to some extent. So it's written from an indigenous lens. It's an indigenous person speaking about the loss of their land, the loss of their forests, the loss of their lakes and rivers, and the loss of their mountains. So, and it says, we don't want to leave our village. Gaon chhodab nahi. Jungle chhodab nahi. We don't want to leave our forests. Mai mati something, ladai chhodab nahi. We don't want to leave our mother, which is our land, and we will not stop fighting. So, that's the lyric. It's also kind of resistance song. It's become a bit of a popular kind of anti displacement song, very popular in many parts.
Gaon chhodab nahi, jungle chhodab nahi, mai mati chhodab nahi, ladai chhodab nahi. Gaon chhodab nahi, jungle chhodab nahi, mai mati chhodab nahi, ladai chhodab nahi.
It's kind of also very poignant because here you have a completely helpless villager or people in a village desperately trying to fight this juggernaut of the industry coming in, development coming in. So it's kind of almost a cry of desperation and despondency. But still, I mean, it sounds like that for somebody who's kind of seeing it from the other side. But for them, it's really a struggle. I mean, it's also a stronger struggle than resistance. And that's what it is. It's, but if you look at the larger scheme of things, you know which side is winning. And I think that's the tragedy of. I think after the Industrial Revolution, this was kind of bound to happen. And now we have the three I's. We've had Industrial Revolution, the Information Revolution, now we're looking at the Intelligence Revolution. So I think each one of them has caused its own levels of damage. I think the first one just destroyed nature, the second one just destroyed you know, people's, I would say destroyed is too strong a word, but it impacted people. Whenever you have a new technology or a new technological, any revolution, you can't just anticipate all the things that are going to happen from it. And I think we are now at the cusp where you've got the intelligence revolution, and people are, on the one hand, completely bewildered by it and fascinated by it, and it does offer that fascination. But there's just so many other aspects, and I think that's what people like, I really like what people like Radhika work on, because they sort of question the assumptions that technology marches ahead with, you know. In fact, we don't question them as much. We just take technology as benevolent and benign and bountiful.
So in fact, our job is, I think it's a very crucial job, especially in a tech institute, to question this assumption that A, technology is neutral, and two, B, that technology can provide solutions for every single problem. So it's and that's a remarkably difficult task to do in a tech institute, especially with young techies who go with these, you know, what are you talking about? Of course, technology can deliver you from every single problem and so on. But it's a challenging job and very interesting. So this song, for example, it picks up on every single popular technology, from the railways from the railways to steel to even national parks and so on, and then talks about what that means, that development model means to someone else. So, you know, I think it's interesting to get people to sit in somebody else's shoes for a while, even if it's for a short while, to say, okay, what if you were not you? What if you were placed in a different situation? How would you then look at the train, at this train that's coming into your village, and so on? So that's what at least some of these classes are meant to do. And yeah, we had a good time in that class.
But I see that the problem, again, if you're going back to educating our young students about all of these problems, it has to start much earlier. I think one of the things that we need to all talk about is, what is the role of education, and what should education be in the 21st century? I mean, we're all so connected, and it's probably for the first time realizing our problems are all so connected, and we're also extremely vulnerable. And I think we need to arrive at some kind of, I wouldn't say it's a new science, but it's a combination of, you know, what's the word Samuel used? Socio-ecological, is that right? Yeah, I think that's got to be at the center of our education systems. And that hasn't happened. I mean, people look at this as a fringe thing, you know, let me take a humanities course or a social science class, and it's a way of, getting rid of some of your guilt about, oh, I'm doing this thing, but you know what, I just took that social science class, so everything should be okay. At least I should feel okay with that. So it's a bigger problem. I think we're if you're going to get engineers and then try to train them into getting sensitive about these things, it's a little too late.
So can we rethink the intelligence revolution to actually be intelligent?
I'm not so convinced. Well, I mean, one is the sheer power of these systems, you know, that they can, I mean, they have billions of pages out, figured out, digested, and they can essentially cook up, generate, is probably the right word, any of this stuff. And it can have tremendous value. I mean, people, but my point is, one's got to be treating very, very carefully. This is a technology that, if it's unleashed by, you know, without the right guardrails, it can. People have already agreed that it can cause havoc in so many ways. I think that debate has to sort of acquire a certain centrality, which unfortunately I don't see that. I mean, maybe I don't read the right journals and articles for these, because I'm not my research interests are not directly into it. I'm more a layman thinking about these problems. With people around, people just like you and Radhika and so on. And that debate, I think, should be done everywhere. I mean, that's a debate that should engage all kinds of people from all walks of life. Because what happens is technology is something that's often imposed from the top. And if you take the case of these AI systems, I mean, nothing is more starkly evident about this, the very tight control of these technologies by just a few companies. You know? So for example, if you're looking at the AI systems like ChatGPT and the other systems, they're all very tightly controlled. You can't, it's not open, although it's called OpenAI, it's not open.
But nobody knows that, frankly.
Right, so that's the thing, and people, the way it is projected, it's always projected as this really benign, wonderful thing that's just come from heaven, or Google, or whatever it is. And Google is almost probably treated as heaven.
Same thing.
So, so I think that's where I don't want to sound too cynical and make sweeping generalizations. But I think our education systems, right from the very first grade, I would say, has got to get kids to understand that they're living in a world, A, that's rapidly changing,
yeah.
Right? And when something is changing rapidly, you know, which way is it headed? You know, what is the limit point of that, of the trajectory, you know? And how one can control it, and how, what, maybe there are these levers that you can control as
Bubble sprite of the forest of Orokanui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, ngā mihi aroha nui kia koutou, ka tāwa hau. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars in your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are and whatever's happening around you, this journey that we're all on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining, and illuminating for you more and more each day. Who you are, a triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique, and here making things better. Thank you. Excuse me coughing at you. Now, I know that for us all, the last several years have been very tough, and you know, we must always remember who we truly are, which is, you know, these beautiful conduits of love, bringing that love energy into the world. And there's so much for us to appreciate and feel grateful about. Of course, it's very important that we share our grievances and we share what we're finding hard, and we ask for support, and we give support, and we provide listening ears and hugging arms and open minds and open hearts, and we give that support when it's needed and when we can, because I believe that we all have the capacity to do so, and that's just part of who we are. And of course, you know, for all of us, this time of year, as we head towards the festive season, can have many beautiful aspects, but also aspects which are challenging. And it's important for us, again, to give that compassion to ourselves, to give that compassion to those around us. And if we can reframe our interactions as opportunities to learn, as opportunities to hear the bells of mindfulness that are chiming to us in each interaction and each moment, then I think things can be a lot less stressful, I hope. And of course, for all of us, when we are having time with our whānau, there's so many wonderful things that we really, really enjoy. I'm very much looking forward to heading out to Portobello and spending time with my beautiful whānau. And I know that we'll have a lovely time, we always do, and it will be very low-key and relaxed, and we'll probably play this card game that my little brother invented, Felix Terrace, which is based on my favourite card game, which is Happy Families. And it's all, it's amazing, it's all the countries of the world, and you know, north, south, east, west of all the countries, and you have to collect, obviously, as many as you can. And my godfather, he would never, you know, participate in any games that we would play. And then finally, when Alex invented this game, he agreed to play, which we were all, oh my goodness, you know, we were really, really pleased and very surprised. Anyway, and then it turned out that he was actually very good at this game and very competitive. And so that's why he hadn't been playing for all these years, you know, my whole life. So fascinating. And it's been really, really great, you know, having him join us and see that different side to him. And, oh, it's been very fun. Well, we've also tried to put on the accents of the different countries, which is quite tricky, but I can do some of them, which is really, really good. So we'll definitely play that. And we'll just have some very simple, you know, food, and it will be very relaxed. So I feel very lucky about that. And I know for everybody, it's going to be a different experience. I know it's going to be an experience unique to you. And but those of you who have whānau overseas, my mother is over in England, I know that it's very tricky at this time of year. So I think as much as we can, give ourselves opportunity to connect with our whānau wherever they are, connect with our loved ones, whether or not we are related by blood. And of course, I was brought up by three friends, so, you know, I'm very fortunate. We can make the families, obviously, that suit us best, which is wonderful. So I hope that you all have a really, really lovely time with your whānau, and I am very grateful to be able to have this time with you all. So a huge thank you to Sam and the whole Blowing Bubbles team for having me, and I'll talk to you again soon. Thanks so much. Ka kite.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. We're talking with Venkatesh Chappella and Radhika Krishnan. Here, perhaps more than in other places, the individual is a small part of a very big machine. How can you empower them to make a difference when at individual level they can't really make much of a difference?
I think the first is education. I mean, if you don't educate them, then we have no hope. We have to, I mean, that's what really education should be. It should be able to give the confidence to an individual that they actually matter and they can make a difference, and they need to make a difference. Otherwise, the balance kind of keeps shifting to, you kind of start losing the game because you don't have control of anything. And I think that's the part of education. Most people, I would think, are intelligent. They don't have to be super intelligent. They're intelligent enough to be able to understand this stuff. This problem, I mean, even at a school level, I think you can get, I mean, we studied fairly complicated things in schools, I mean, Newton's equations, and this is not more complex than that, it's at one level.
I would say that I'm a little, you know, I share that skepticism and that worry about, you know, how can an individual make a change. Partly because I have done this job of trying to, for years together, trying to convince people and trying to get together a group of people to, you know, to change stuff. It's hard. It's really hard. But at the same time, I agree with Venkatesh that some kind of, you know, now I've kind of changed my style of thinking and saying instead of focusing on, you know, thinking about morality and ethics and all of that, that doesn't seem to work anymore. But if people were to genuinely just think about even enlightened self-interest, what are you doing with the world? What are you doing with the systems that you're building? Have you even thought about it? And if this starts at an early age, as you say, I completely agree with you there, one really has to sort of change the framework of thinking at a very young age.
And I think this is where I thought about this a little bit, and I came to realize that you had this nice question in the middle of your talk the other day about what is the purpose of computing. And I think computing can, what people often are not able to honestly think beyond the immediate and what is around them. It's hard. I mean, it's very hard to extrapolate. I mean, it's very hard for people to understand what an exponential function is. In fact, a lot of the problem with COVID was just that. People didn't understand exponentials. How fast something can grow is beyond the grasp of many ordinary people. And so if you want to predict, you know, at this rate of whatever, consumption, pollution, whatever activity you look at, how far can you go before it gets completely intolerable? I mean, what is, for example, if you like a human being, you know, what is the temperature, level of pollution that literally can, you know, beyond which no human beings can live, for example. I mean, suppose the temperature is increased by not 1.5, the average temperature, but goes up by, let's say, 10 degrees. Things are out, right? So how do I tell a little kid, you know, or maybe a student who's studying computer science or maths or physics, let's just look at those for now, because these are the people who are going to get into powerful positions later on. How do I convince them about growth? You know, how does something grow? How does a system grow?
Yeah.
You know, and if a system grows non-linearly, for example, you know, where does it end up? Without the kind of controls you build around it, where could you end up?
Has the idea of degrowth got any traction here?
Absolutely no.
In fact, I didn't hear this word degrowth before, unless you mentioned it. So
no.
I'm not quite tuned into it.
In fact,
degrowth,
there is an economist friend and colleague of mine whose office is upstairs, Anikvan, who has been trying to talk about degrowth in his class. And I mean, he is a development economist, and he is. We've had several discussions on how degrowth might be an idea in Europe and so on, but in India,
so
it's
maybe
you
want to repeat what degrowth is.
No, the idea that, since you brought Donella Meadows into the conversation. So Donella Meadows, of course, one of her best known works was the idea that there are limits to growth.
Of course.
And at that point of time, there was a lot of pushback saying growth is not a nasty word, it's not a bad word, and all of that. So degrowth essentially comes with this idea that one needs to not just maintain the current level of consumption, but actively bring it down. So you need to think of very different models, economic models, in order to sustain the world. So degrowth, you come back. And it's a standard, I mean, it's very well known in economic theory. But in India, the idea of degrowth is a non-starter as of now, unfortunately.
And I can understand that, particularly if you're going to try and take some sort of average, because clearly we've got to pull the bottom up.
Yeah.
But in lots of cases, I think that places like India have been tricked by the West into thinking that the top involves driving a Rolls Royce.
Absolutely.
And that's overshoot, and it doesn't seem necessary. And for them, the concepts of decoupling consumption from well-being, that seems like a doable task. But we can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
We can't put it down onto those individuals that are at the bottom and say, just be happy.
I think one thing that might be going for India, which is again a big if, is the traditions in India. India is a civilization that is at least 2,000 or 3,000 years old, and this is true with most earlier civilizations. Most of their practices were sustainable. I mean, that is because as an individual, you couldn't, an average individual probably never traveled more than a few kilometers in their entire life, maybe a few tens of kilometers. So naturally the impact on the biosphere that you had was very limited just because of your the way you lived. Many of those traditions have still survived, for example, in India. When I was growing up, you didn't see plastic bags. You just saw newspapers. You'd buy some, you'd buy vegetables. You took your own bag. You know, took a gunny bag or a jute bag, and that's still there. So there are just hundreds of such examples of traditions where people have lived in sustainable ways, and those traditions still persist. You know, so I think that's good. I mean, if you can somehow revive those traditional traditions and make conscious that look how beautifully, you know, sustainable these traditions were. I think that in a place like India, that's actually not hard to sell, because people already are aware of those traditions, and it's just a matter of reminding them how important or in fact critical it is now to hang on to those. So I'll give you another example. I mean, when most people who come from abroad, I mean, all of us, we drink bottled water. But bottled water is a very recent thing. I mean, I would say when I was growing up, there was nothing like bottled water, which is like, what, 30, 40 years ago. But you go to a city or you go to any place, you have a big, a water pot. You just take water from there, you take water from, and that's still done in most parts of India. If you go to government offices, this will happen. And there are traditional ways, you're talking about refrigerators, there are traditional ways of cooling water. You just put it in an earthen pot, and the water vapor evaporates and the water cools. It's very simple, it works. You know, at various places, there are traditional ways of cooling homes, which have worked quite well. I mean, and even the British used those, but they were in India 200 years ago. So those things, I think, have, if properly sort of campaigned for, they have a chance of helping. Because you can't think of everybody in India having an air conditioner. Thank God.
But in terms of aspiration, it's hard to match that up against like a giant television screen. You've got a giant television screen in your office.
Yeah. Why?
I presume it belongs to a lecture theatre or something.
Yeah,
it's enormous.
No, it does. It's a board. I agree. I know. I mean, we all live in multiple, you know, cynical worlds. The point is, but you're right. I mean, there's a lot that's done at individual level. If you look at people like us here living in a city, our patterns of consumption are no different from somebody living in New York or California. There's no difference. In fact, we're probably on par. We eat the same kind of cereal, we eat the same kind of cookies, we drink the same kind of coffee, and we drive very similar cars. I mean, so I don't see where the difference is. But
although your commute's quite small.
Yes, I mean, yeah, I can be proud of that. And maybe my footprint is that much lower, you know. Yeah.
So.
No, but coming back to what you said, I completely agree with what Venkatesh says, but see, there is this grand narrative about what is good life that has come precisely from a very Eurocentric lens. And that narrative needs to be challenged, and it needs to be challenged in multiple ways. What is sad is that that challenge is happening in Europe. But in India, it's kind of, it's a complicated game, because the minute you start challenging that, the idea is, why are you telling us to do it now? Because this is our time has just come, and it's our time to own 5 homes and these 3 fancy cars and everything else. And
that's true.
And you know, when we try to say that, look, you can be, this wasn't part of our culture, this wasn't part of our way of thinking about the good life. It's hard, you know, that the conversation is very hard. Think of what, that's why I'm saying, I think the way forward, at least in India or maybe large parts of the global south, is to actually tell people about enlightened self-interest. As in, look, how far can you go if everybody wants an air conditioner, or even if a large proportion of your population wants 3 houses and 5 air conditioners in each of those homes? How can you go? Which is why Don LaMeadows is so important. Those models are so important.
I agree. I think the case has been made in a very, and that's why I keep tying it to education, because I think what you want to be able to teach is how to have people be happy, and as you said, it can be taught. You know, it has to be taught. It has to be taught, because if you don't teach that, people come up with other ideas of what it means to be happy, and I think that is a problem. And I always felt that there are tremendous opportunities, despite all the, you know, the gloom that we see around, in taking small things and making them happen, you know, in small ways. And they do add up. I mean, they do add up, and they can add up. If you're looking at, for example, if you look at transport, you get trains, you get a large sector of the biggest, one of the large ways in which the environment is impacted is through agriculture. I mean, agricultural produce. And there is tradition, especially in the drier parts of India, of growing cereals that are that grow in arid climates, you know, millets and so on.
Actually, I put 2 very similar songs as my second choice, but both of them evoked certain memories for me. I told you I worked a lot as an activist for a while, as a student activist. And those songs we used to sing as part of our mobilization efforts. So one of them is essentially, I'll do a rough translation. It essentially is a spoof on the political class, And it talks about how it's a Fares, Ahmed Fares song. It's Fares at his ironic and sarcastic best. So he's talking about ye galiyon ke awaare kutte, as in dogs. And he's on the face of it, the song is about dogs. But what he's trying to say is that the political class tends to think of human beings, large parts of human of the human population, as dogs whom you can just throw a couple of breads to and make them happy. And the song Fares is trying to tell the dog slash human being, learn your worth, figure out who you what, figure out the power that you actually can yield if you come together as a collective, and so on. So, and then he ends, the last line says, if only the dog were to wake up and to understand what power it has, and then this dog can conquer the universe. So I just, that is the second song.
Yes.
कोई इनको एहसास दिला दे,
So for this first part of our conversation, I have some questions to end the show that Venkatesh is going to answer.
Sure.
That means Radhika gets a sneak preview of the questions. That was a clever move. What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Okay, my notion of success is not, it might be slightly different, but I think a notion of success I've had is the understanding of computing from a systems perspective, which has been actually around all this while. But I think what I've managed to sort of think through a good part of traditional computer science curriculum from a systems perspective, which consciously or unconsciously has been driven by this larger notion of systems and sustainability that we've been talking about. I mean, when you read books like Donella Meadows' book, Thinking in Systems and books like that, you sort of wonder, why is it that computing as a field, which actually developed very closely with, you know, cybernetics was but basically computing developed very closely with notions of control and systems, you know. Robert Wiener is the name I was looking for. So he's the one who coined the term cybernetics, right? But sort of the curriculum shifted into mostly about coding and programs, and it continues to this day. And I'm trying to, I think what I'm sort of trying to understand over the last few years, and which I think I'd like to think that with some success, is that there's a different way of understanding these things without bringing coding to, the center stage. It's not about coding. In fact, if you look at the conference we just had, a large number of papers is just about coding and programming. And I think that that limits and greatly limits our view of what computing can be. And I think that is that realization that I've been designing some electives around this idea that I would think is
we are writing a book of these conversations. It's called Tomorrow's Heroes. It's our team of people doing good work. So you are in that team. What's your superpower?
What's my superpower?
Yep.
As in? I mean, what is it that I have that others can contribute?
If you say flying, I'm going to ask for a real one.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure. I think our powers come from the way we think, and I think the way we teach them. It's a little immodest to say that.
I'll talk about his superpower.
Okay.
He has the ability to think outside the box and to think of situations which are, nobody else can think is possible, and he manages to get that done. That is Venkatesh's superpower.
Wow.
Good superpower. Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
No, hardly.
So what motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
What gets me out of bed in the morning is often I've not slept enough. but I think I'm not so driven by passion that I should get out of bed and start thinking. I don't know. I find some of these questions a bit strange, because this is not how we lead our ordinary lives. I mean, I'm just an ordinary person. So
what is the biggest challenge or opportunity you're looking forward to in the next year or so?
I want to work and see that I can combine systems teaching with computer science. That's really what I'm trying to do. We're also working on a book on that with a colleague of mine. But I don't know when it'll get done. But I think if I can somehow impact the curriculum and the way we think about computing, connecting it with these ideas, frankly, about sustainability, environment, justice. I think the time has come for this idea, and we have to do something about it. And I think that's what frankly motivates me right now. I'm not looking at sort of delving deeper into technology. I'm no longer interested in that aspect, but I'm interested in this other aspect, which is in some sense, the complement of technology, whatever is around technology, And in whatever limited ways we can, I mean, I'm not a sociologist or trained as an economist or I'm not trained in social science, but I think, again, you know, I think the strength comes when I can work with social scientists and we can share these ideas and complement each other's capacities, you know. And that is, I think, exciting. And honestly, in IIID, I'm quite fortunate to see that we have a very vibrant, a small but extremely vibrant group of social scientists. And I think that's something that, and natural scientists, and people who work in biology, people who work in physics. And I think that this is a great opportunity for a place like ours, which is actually quite small compared to a regular university, to engage with them.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Learn to think big. Don't stop at coding. You know, coding is a very small part of or whatever you're doing. Connect and think big. You've got to, because your problems are big. They're not like, we were lucky, you know, but we're going to survive this whole thing and probably disappear after some time. But these people are going to be born with these problems. Your listeners, I'm assuming most of your listeners are young, much younger than us. So there you go.
Thank you for that. Thank you both for joining me.
Welcome.
We're going to be back next week.
Thank you.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.